When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm Oliver Wiseman, editor of CapEx and your host of Free Exchange. 2019 has started with a bang in British politics. Theresa May's deal with the European Union was given a resounding thumbs down by the House of Commons on Tuesday. The Prime Minister may have survived a vote of no confidence yesterday, but what happens next is far from clear. To try to make some sense of this madness, I spoke to Henry Newman, director of Open Europe, and one of the most eagle-eyed Brexit watchers in SW1. So, Henry Newman, welcome back to Free Exchange. I want to start by asking you what has changed in Brexit in the last 48 hours. There's been a lot of noise and a lot of action, but in terms of the choices Britain faces, what has changed?
Well, absolutely nothing has changed. We're back to exactly where we were before, which is that there are still only three options available. Those options are to leave the EU without a deal, to leave the EU with a version of the Prime Minister's deal, and to not leave the EU, probably through a referendum, but it also could, of course, be through withdrawal of Article 50 unilaterally. Those are the only three options. Nothing has changed, and, of course, the Prime Minister clings on in Downing Street.
What does the most recent developments mean in terms of the likelihood of those outcomes?
So, obviously, this was a very, very big defeat. It was at the upper end of what people was expecting. But it wasn't entirely a surprise. I think we saw well-placed journalists like Alex Wickham at BuzzFeed suggesting that we were considerably north of 100 Conservatives opposing the deal last month. And we also saw roughly the same number of Conservatives vote against the Prime Minister's leadership in a vote of confidence in her in December as voted against her deal earlier this week. So it's not a huge surprise. I think the problem is that some of the opposition to the deal is, of course, based on the policy substance of what's actually in the text. But some of it also is, to be completely frank, personal and political rather than anything substantive. And the question that we need to try and find out the answer to over the next few days and weeks is whether those Conservative backbenchers are looking for ladders to climb down or crosses to crucify themselves on. And because the Prime Minister has called time on her own leadership and fired the starting gun on the race to succeed her, a lot of MPs are now focusing on a future prize. And that's causing a lot of problems in terms of, I think, the capacity or the willingness of certain big beast backbenchers to compromise.
But you don't see it as moving Brexit in one direction or the other. Does it make no deal more likely or a softer Brexit more likely?
I think a softer Brexit is marginally more likely. I think no deal remains unlikely because I think a group of MPs are trying their very best to block it. And I sort of got a wind of this plan to try and seize control of the House of Parliament, changing the standing orders and put it's in its current form. It's no longer the liaison committee in charge, but different versions have suggested even putting the liaison committee headed by Sarah Wollaston in charge of Brexit, which I think would be mad. I got wind of this a few days ago and discussed it sort of privately with Nikki Da Costa, who was head of legislative affairs in Number 10 formerly. And she said it was very difficult to see how that could work because, of course, standing orders are controlled by the government and the order of selection of private members' bills is also controlled by the government and so on. But she also worried me because she said it's not impossible. And I just thought then that if you had a speaker who was willing, this is before the speaker seized control and selected the Grieve Amendment. If you had a speaker who was willing to do almost anything, bend the rules, even potentially go against the strong advice of Clark, so the Commons, then it was possible that would happen. So I think no deal is less likely than it could have been. But I also find it rather grating when I hear MPs who voted themselves for Article 50 say that they don't want no deal, demand it's taken off the table, but also refuse to back a deal. That is also a ridiculous position. At the other extreme, the idea of a second referendum. I don't think that's getting a huge amount of traction still, luckily. I think we've got, within the Labour Party, very, very divided opinions still. Lots of MPs would clearly like it. But I think the more that we hear from Tony Blair and Peter Mandelson, the less likely the Corbynites are to back the idea of a second referendum. It remains possible. And of course, we currently have fewer than a dozen Tory MPs in favour of it. But that could grow. And I think the problem is that there are some Tories, particularly within the government, who are pretty soft Remainers, and they're beginning to feel, and Tobias Elwood has articulated that the mandate for the referendum, the mandate for leave, is going to expire soon. And they feel that they've, to an extent, discharged some of their duties by voting for the Prime Minister's deal once, and they may not necessarily feel bound to do it again. And that comes on to what will happen to this deal. So, you know, should the Prime Minister move softer or move harder? I think she'll be under lots of pressure to move softer, because the difficulty for her going harder is that the EU won't wear it. The EU, we already know that the backstop is the sine qua non of any negotiated deal with the EU. So she can't really move very far on that. She might get a tweak or two on the exit of it later on, but she needs to have a clear ask, and she doesn't yet have that. And moving softer is obviously easier, because the EU would be perfectly happy to accept that. It's difficult for her politically, because it would split her cabinet and split the party very badly. And again, I think there's quite a lot of disingenuous posturing here. The calls for a permanent customs union are slightly ridiculous, because at the heart of the backstop is, of course, a customs union that can only be ended by mutual agreement. That is the very problem with it, as far as most of the ERG are concerned. And I simply don't understand why people would oppose the current deal but seek a permanent customs union, which is essentially pretty much a similar thing. Or equally, on something like workers' rights, where it is, of course, open to any future government to harmonise, to introduce any rule from the EU that they like on workers' rights, or equally from Canada or New Zealand or anywhere else that comes up with a good piece of legislation. And that, of course, does happen sometimes. So I think as to go back to something I said a minute ago, some of the opposition to this is just political. And especially, I think, when you look at the Labour Party, it's very clearly so.
And that, just to clear up that specific point, the objections, oddly, on the softer side, the objections are to the non-binding bit of Theresa May's deal, so that to the political declaration rather than to the binding stuff. Is that broadly accurate?
I think it's difficult to say. So there are calls from within the Conservative Party for a Plan B, by which most people mean a version of Norway Plus. Now, the problem with Plan B, heading for Norway Plus, there's lots of substantive reasons why I think being in the single market and customs union would be a very poor version of Brexit. I think it would be a politically unsustainable position for the medium term. I think in negotiating terms, it'd be very difficult, because actually the EU wouldn't let us just have Norway in inverted commas. We would be in the transition period trying to negotiate a new version of Norway, because we couldn't have the regular off-the-shelf model. And in so doing, we'd set ourselves up with all sorts of negotiating cliff edges, where Monsieur Macron would say, well, look, you can have a version of Norway, but we're going to need to have tighter controls on the city and financial services. We're going to need to have more of your fish. The Spanish would say, we'd love a bit of your Gibraltar. And they'd all say, we want loads of your money. So I think that would be very difficult. But I also think that Plan B, so-called, is really just Plan A with a different bow on it, because it's premised on accepting the entirety of the withdrawal agreement, including the backstop. All of that would be as it currently is. And all they do, as you said, is tweak the political declaration and narrow the range of choices for the future. I don't think it's very sensible. But I think if you look at the Labour Party's opposition, we heard Barry Gardiner say yesterday that their concern was really with the political declaration, not the withdrawal agreement. And of course, that's more reasonable, because the EU has really locked down both of them. But the EU would be more happy, I think, to open the political declaration than the withdrawal agreement. But that's, I don't think Barry Gardiner is, this is not the first time, Barry Gardiner, the shadow trade secretary, often says quite a bit of truth. I don't think he's actually where necessarily the Labour leadership really are, or the Labour strategists would be. And they're unlikely to throw the Prime Minister that sort of lifeline. Look, Labour's Brexit policy is to have a deal with the EU that delivers the exact same benefits as membership. That is manifestly impossible, as the Commissioner said, and as everybody else has said. And Barry Gardiner, of course, described it famously as bollocks.
Let's talk about some of the Conservative critics on the harder end of the Brexit spectrum. You know, lots of them have very reasonable frustrations with the withdrawal agreement, even if you're pro the deal, there's a lot not to like in there. So, you know, the EU has made clear, for now at least, the withdrawal agreement is not to be touched and they aren't going to budge on it. Do you think that will remain true as sort of departure looms? I mean, if May decided to go hard rather than soft, is there any scope for a harder deal, or is it sort of this deal or no deal?
I think the problem from the EU side is their space for manoeuvre is actually quite limited, and the Irish government in particular is very vulnerable. There is, unfortunately, from our point of view, unanimous agreement within the Irish Parliament that the backstop needs to stay. And I think if they did anything to really soften that, it'd be very difficult for them, and the EU would be extremely loath to move in that direction. So I think some clarifications. I think there are, as you suggested in your question, very reasonable concerns with the deal, and I share lots of those concerns. I personally had been coming round to the idea that we were going to have to compromise more and get a what I would consider a less optimal Brexit ever since the Prime Minister lost her majority in June of 2017. Because I think at that point it became very difficult to see how the threat to really walk away was actually as credible as it had been before. But I think that the other difficulty is, of course, that the Prime Minister has achieved certain things since she agreed with the EU at the European Council back in December. She did actually get an exchange of letters with the European Council that was quite substantive. It did provide for quite a lot of things. This was dismissed entirely out of hand by some of her critics in the most ridiculous way, as being completely pointless and not worth the paper it's printed on or whatever they said. This is just silly. A exchange of letters of that sort can be, in international law, a mini treaty that is as binding as anything else. And I think what the Prime Minister has been able to do, and this hasn't yet been received well by her critics again, but she's now said very clearly that if we end up in the backstop, which is the worst case scenario of the current deal, any new law which would create a potential regulatory barrier between Northern Ireland and Great Britain would be subject to a veto by the Northern Irish Assembly. And I think, in brackets, the Prime Minister has been appallingly bad at explaining her own deal. She's a terrible salesman for her own policy, close brackets. But if she was able to say a bit more clearly, look, even if we're in the backstop, we can resist new deals. So we can resist new laws applying to Northern Ireland. And it may be that there's a new law that comes along that Northern Ireland's completely relaxed about. They may decide that this actually makes perfect sense for their dairy farmers, and they're happy in this circumstance. That goes through the democratic check of being approved by the Stormont institutions, the Northern Ireland Executive and Assembly.
In that case, access the single market on quite generous terms.
Right, and this is although the DUP and the UUP have been very, very critical for the deal, they're not the only voices within Northern Ireland, and some, while acknowledging the constitutional problems, the potential issue that it presents for the Good Friday Agreement, some people have also said, well, actually, there are some advantages here. And I think, again, this is a question of whether the DUP ultimately want to implacably oppose this deal, come what may, or whether they're willing to find a certain thing that they will actually change their mind on. We don't yet know.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Lots of people in lots of different Brexit camps have made a similar point in the last few days, which is that we're barreling towards this deadline, and that the, you know, the only option, the most sensible thing now is for an extension to Article 50. Just talk me through, like, whether that's possible, what that would entail, what that would solve.
An extension, I think, is, first of all, it's highly undesirable. I would,
from Britain's point of view.
From Britain's point of view. I think also from the EU's point of view. I mean, really, I think most people want to resolve this and move on. I thought we heard Herman Van Rompuy say that it was impossible to extend beyond July, and that's because within the Lisbon Treaty itself, there's a particular number of MEPs that have to be elected. If Britain is part of those elections, then Britain has to have an allocation of MEPs, and that means that, assuming that France would not be electing the extra MEPs that they would have if we left. I think the EU has previously said quite clearly that we can extend Article 50 in two circumstances, a general election or a referendum. Neither of those seem immediately likely. And another circumstance is for a technical extension to allow for ratification to be completed. Now, that's possible. And that would be a situation where, say, we passed the meaningful vote, but we hadn't yet got the withdrawal agreement on the statute books. So we'd sort of signed up to leaving on the terms of the deal, but you hadn't tied off all the knots in domestic law. And in that case, I think we can imagine an extension of a few weeks.
But that's sort of separate kind of extension. Really.
Right. What's not on offer is an extension to reopen the negotiations, have another go at all of this, and just get a better offer on the backstop. That's what the Labour Party's position is, and it's ridiculous.
So in terms of what's likely to happen then, you think there'll be a version of Theresa May's deal going back to the House of Commons, and how does that either you think no deal's going to happen, or you think there's a way in which that deal passes. How does the deal pass?
These two blocks within the Commons are at opposite ends of the debate, and their positions are entirely antithetical. There's one block who want no deal now at any cost, almost, and there's another deal that wants to block no deal at any cost. And at least one of those groups, and possibly both of them, are going to be very, very disappointed. And the danger, I think, that we're now in is that the people who claim to love Brexit the most, particularly the ERG, are the ones who are the most in danger of killing Brexit overall, or at least ending up with a much more suboptimal version of Brexit. Because the only real direction the Prime Minister can go, if the ERG and the DUP set themselves implacably against any version of her deal, is to soften and to find support amongst the Labour backbenchers. And I think that's not what she should do, because I think what they're asking for in terms of a permanent customs union doesn't make sense. But that is where she will be forced to go.
Well, someone from the ERG might reply to that by saying the law as it stands is that we leave. You know, it's hard to see how Theresa May cobbles together the numbers for a version of Brexit. So, you know, are they really risking Brexit, or are they just, you know, being more realistic than you are about the no deal being what's going to happen?
So they're right that the law as it currently stands is that we leave on March 29th. But of course, there's a caveat there, which is as it currently stands, and Parliament is capable of changing the law. And that's the very basis on which the anti-no deal planners are currently proceeding. They want to put Parliament in charge of this process. I think that would be a disaster. We discussed earlier the suggestion that the liaison committee would be put in charge of Brexit. I don't think that would lead to a better outcome. That's a committee that has a range of opinion stretching from Sarah Wollaston to Bill Cash, from Bernard Jenkins to Nicky Morgan. I don't think it's any more united than the Cabinet. And I think that if you've been looking at the Hansard of the debates over the last few days in the Commons, there is an enormous amount of unicorn chasing and magical thinking. You've got different MPs all coming up with their versions of the ideal possible Brexit that they would love in a fantasy world, and different MPs saying their perfect way of stopping Brexit or softening it or whatever else. And I think there is more confusion about basic facts and more confusion about what's actually possible than there has been at almost any point in this debate. So I think putting Parliament in charge is not a good thing. And as a senior backbencher from the Tory side recently said to me, the danger is also that if you have the division bell ringing repeatedly, MPs voting on amendment after amendment, rushing into different division lobbies, that is not a good process for actual rational, calm decision-making about a real issue of national crisis. I think that MPs need to think very, very carefully about whether they can live with the Prime Minister's deal, ultimately get out on the terms that we've currently agreed, and then improve it from then on. And I think that is a much more sustainable path forward. I can be as relaxed as about no deal as I like, but I think that the chances are that Parliament, working with the Speaker, will find a way to block it.
And let's talk about no deal then. Some people do think it's quite likely. And you know, what's your sense of how prepared Britain is for no deal, how worried we should be about no deal?
So we did some work at Open Europe on the medium-term effects of no deal and found that actually over the medium term, the economic hit is relatively small. It's material, but it's small over a 13-year period. Well, what we couldn't model for, because it's very difficult to, was the disruption that would be inherent in no deal. And I think that would be quite profound. And it's particularly profound because the EU is not that willing to ultimately lend us, we don't know how willing the EU would be to lend a hand to us. If we wound the clock back a few months, when the EU was still saying that we'd have to have a Northern Ireland-only backstop, I think you could have imagined a situation where we went for no deal. And even Tory Remain MPs were saying to me, there is no way I will accept a deal that divides the UK with a customs border down the Irish Sea. And I think in that situation, the moral high ground would have been on our side in going for a no deal and saying, we can't accept this. No country would accept it. The whole of the Commons has voted against a customs border in the Irish Sea. And therefore, in sorrow and regret, will go for no deal. And I think the moral pressure would have been on the EU to reach side agreements. I don't think that will be the case now. I think the EU do think that they've offered us a deal, and the Prime Minister has agreed that deal. Our manifesto position as Conservatives was that no deal is better than a bad deal, but not no deal is better than any deal. And when I listen to some of the things that people are saying about no deal and leaving on WTO terms, it just strikes me I don't know what the right polite word is.
I guess one of the points about this would be that people are talking about different things often when they're talking about no deal. So you can have a conversation, right, about the consequences of trading on certain terms. You can make the point that that's not
of course,
so bad,
of course, but this is not
separate to the
yes,
logistical
so,
question.
Of course. So again, there are a lot of confusions here, and even if the tariffs part of this would not be the main problem. Mm-hmm. It's the rules of origins issues and so on that would come up as a result of leaving on WTO terms. We don't trade on WTO terms with other major economies like the US. We have all kinds of side agreements that facilitate trade. So it would be very problematic. And it would also, by definition, mean a profound breakdown in relations with our nearest neighbours. It would mean no surety for UK nationals living abroad. It would mean legal uncertainty. It would mean huge problems for data. I think you can go on and on and on. But I think fundamentally, it would also drive a wedge through the heart of the Conservative Party, which would be totally and possibly irreversibly split over this. And I think that's not a question of national interest, but it's a question that Conservative MPs should be very worried about. And I think that clearly people voted to leave the European Union. It's important that we deliver that mandate. But is there a clear mandate for a no-deal exit? I don't think there is. I think if you look back at what the Leave campaign were actually saying during the referendum, they were saying that we would be part of a free trade area that stretched from Iceland to the Russian border. They said that there were all kinds of models available for the EU's relationship with its near neighbours. There was Turkey, there was Switzerland, there was Norway. But we were not going to have any of those. We're going to have a bespoke deal. But they said we'd have a deal. They didn't say we'd leave without a deal. Mm. And I think the argument that many anti-dealers are saying is that this deal is terrible because we can't do free trade deals. Fair enough. That is a problem with the current deal. We can't do our own free trade deals. But why are you, if you're so determined to do free trade deals, why are you so relaxed about leaving on WTO terms where you'd have a free trade deal with no one? And why don't you want to do a free trade deal with Europe? Now, of course, Europe is not our only market and other markets are growing very quickly, but it is our largest single market. And I think it makes sense to leave on good terms, agree an orderly divorce, and then we can work out our future relationship in slower time.
On the point about the Conservative Party, I mean, it's, you know, I don't need to tell you how poisonous this debate has become. And isn't that kind of split or massive rupture looking more and more inevitable? I mean, if there was a softer Brexit or no Brexit at all, then, you know, someone whose job, if someone's making decisions based on what keeps the Conservative Party together, it's not obvious that
anything can.
Yeah.
Look, that's a risk, absolutely. And politics are in this huge state of flux at the moment, and all parties are divided. I mean, the Liberal Democrats have lost one of their dozen elected MPs, who's now not voting with them because he disagrees on Brexit. The Labour Party are divided. The Conservatives are divided, yes. But I think, you know, it's possible that some MPs at either end of the party might split in different directions in the future. Sure. But that's different from a fundamental wedge being driven through the very heart of the party, which I think leaving on no deal terms would do, however relaxed personally I am about it. And I think that actually you're right that there are these big divisions. These divisions, of course, have been in the Conservative Party also for many decades. And a counter to that, though, is just to wonder what would happen if this is the sort of counterfactual I was engaging in earlier this week. Imagine if we woke up and the Prime Minister's deal had passed on Tuesday night, and we were now leaving the EU on those terms, and we could all move on to discussing what sort of relationship we want in the future with the EU, where we put the question of whether we should or shouldn't leave behind us, finally, after 3 years of groundhog debate, and actually start worrying about what sort of relationship we want to secure, but also what we want to do with the health service, with social care, all these other things which are actually fundamentally important to the country. And I also thought that listening to Michael Gove's wind-up in the House of Commons yesterday evening, the atmosphere was electric, and the party was really reminded about why we're all Conservatives. And all Conservative MPs voted with the government on that confidence motion, as you'd expect. And it was a unified position, because ultimately it was a clear enemy, the sort of looming prospect of a Corbyn government. So I'm not convinced the party will split if this is done in the right way.
Okay, let's go from that very broad question to a more specific one, which is just walk listeners through kind of what happens next. So as we're recording this now, Theresa May and the government are holding talks with other parties to see what sort of compromises might be out there. And then what's the next, in the kind of parliamentary diary, what's the next step on the Brexit story?
So by Monday, the Prime Minister has to reintroduce a motion to the Commons, which will be amendable. And then we'll have this sort of competition for MPs to attract the maximum possible number of supporters to their amendments, and we'll see which ones the Speaker selects. And the vote will come, the next meaningful vote will be on the 29th of January. So the Prime Minister has a bit of time bought. And in the meantime, there's going to be parliamentary stasis and not very much happening. Now, of course, the Prime Minister is speaking to the leadership and also backbenchers in different parties, perfectly sensibly, but she's also not at this point willing to move in any direction, really. And I think what we possibly could see next time round is some of that opposition to her deal beginning to slowly retreat. And I think that would, even if she was defeated by an extraordinary margin this week, even if she managed to persuade 40 of her own MPs to, they've registered their disapproval of the deal. She persuaded them to abstain. She persuaded some Labour MPs to cross the benches and vote with the government. I think it could suddenly seem like actually this was beginning to look more and more winnable. And she may have to make some concessions, and that's the danger, the calculation that I think speaking to some ERG people, they're very worried about, that if they continue to hold out a sort of nihilistic position, then the Prime Minister will go softer. And then that makes it much, much worse for them in the medium term. So I think there's a lot to play for over the next few days and weeks. But I don't think the Prime Minister's deal's at all dead, because it remains the only negotiated deal with the EU.
Henry Newman, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Henry Newman on Brexit. Thanks for listening.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.